for those who don't really understand the concept of it all, where did it all begin?
Well, it sort of began fair way back in the 1850s, so middle of the 19th century. Pastoralists began bringing stock up to the high country then, essentially for summer relief type grazing. And that was in New South Wales and Victoria, parts of Tasmania as well. And, you know, in New South Wales, stock came from a fair old way away, you know, from the Murray Basin, from, you know, Wagga, from, you know, places a fair old way away, and up to the high country for a feed during summer.
So was the high country, was it a bit of a thoroughfare anyway and just a good place to stop and prop, or did those cattlemen just know, well, it'll be good grazing up there, we'll just head that way?
Well, I guess so. I mean, I'm not an expert on the history of the development of it, but that's my understanding, that, you know, essentially the cattlemen found out about the country around about the same time the scientists did too. Baron Ferdinand von Mueller was up in the high country collecting plants and making observations about the way the landscape worked at around about the same time. So, you know, we scientists have been up there for just as long.
How relevant is the work that Ferdinand von Mueller had done in those days? Do you still have a look at some of the information that he gathered and try and build on that?
Oh, I guess the early days was it was sort of natural science, you know, going out collecting, making. And you remember, this 1850, Victoria was still a colony, so, you know, this was very early days in the history of our country. But, you know, we got stuck into the science nice and early. The natural history that was worked out for the plants and animals served us well in, you know, the coming years, decades and indeed centuries, because the observations of these early scientific pioneers, you know, formed a very, very important platform for the way we learn about landscapes. And, we, you know, that's the way science works. You go out and you observe something, you know, you have an idea about the way the country might work. You then try and manipulate it in some sort of way. You know, we can do landscape scale type experiments and make conclusions about the data that we collect. So, you know, science works by observation, knowing something about the way plants, animals and landscapes work and the way in which humans interact with it.
So would it be fair to say that the collection of scientific data has probably gone hand in hand with cattle grazing from day dot?
Well, yes, I guess so. Although the there were early observations about the impact of cattle grazing made in the late 19th century with some of the early scientists. But I guess really the work took off in the post-World War II period, especially in the Kosciuszko area of New South Wales, where there was concern about the state of the high mountain catchments in relation to the developing Snowy Mountain scheme. So there was a lot of concern that a lot of bare ground around the place, a lot of impact of the combination of burning and grazing at very high altitudes had removed the precious vegetation cover, soil had been exposed, and the risk of soil erosion was elevated because of that. And so a lot of folks were simply worried that, well, is this silt going to end up in our dams and, you know, ruin the hydro scheme? Mm-hmm. So that was a big part of it. And then the science was turned towards thinking about nature conservation and, I guess, the, you know, the inherent values of the alpine landscape. But, I mean, it is a beautiful part of the country.
And nature conservation was one of the key elements to force the cattlemen out of the high country just some years ago. That was probably one of the key ones. But since then, the cattlemen have always argued, and their supporters have argued, and I'm not sure how strong the evidence is, but it has always been anecdotal that grazing means no blazing, that the fact that they have the cattle up there means that there will be grasslands will be kept lower, that there will be some impact from the cattle in reducing the severity of fires in the high country. What evidence is there to support it? We've heard it anecdotally, but what evidence, scientific evidence, is there to support that?
To support the notion that grazing reduces blazing?
Mm.
Well, in fact, I'm not aware of any great body and portfolio of landscape scale evidence that actually supports that idea. I looked at this particular question after the 2003 fires across the Bogong High Plains. We went out and did a very, very comprehensive survey, compared grazed and ungrazed areas of the Bogong High Plains at landscape-type scale. So I walked 100 kilometres, I surveyed 100 square kilometres of country. I stopped at, you know, something like 400 points across the landscape and looked at whether the country had been burnt, and if it had, how severely it had been burnt. And then with appropriate statistical analyses, we compared the grazed country with the ungrazed country on the Bogong High Plains, and we could find no difference, no impact of grazing on the pattern of burning, whether the proportion of country that had been burnt or in the severity with which it had been burnt.
Why is that?
Well, there's a number of reasons for it. One is that at least across the Bogong High Plains, the most flammable parts of the landscape are in fact the sort of closed heathland areas on the steeper slopes. So you've got tall shrubs on steeper slopes. That sort of fuel combination is highly flammable. And it turns out that those sorts of shrubby species are not eaten by the cattle. And that sort of habitat type, if you like, the closed heath, is not an area where the cattle go, you know, prefer to graze. In fact, they avoid it. So the most flammable bit of the landscape has relatively little impact in fuel reduction. On the grasslands, though, there was, there's evidence of grazing reducing the cover and abundance and biomass of some of the snow grasses, and indeed the other herbs that grow in the grassland with the snow grasses. But that's a relatively unflammable part of the landscape. It's generally on flatter slopes, and the grasses themselves are less flammable than the shrubs. So across the Bogong High Plains, only about 15% of the grasslands burnt during 2003. And that proportion of burning was roughly the same in grazed and ungrazed country. And you compare that with the closed heath, where about 85% of the country burnt. And it's, you know, quite indicative of the fact that fire spread across the landscape is highly dependent on the nature of the fuel type. So whatever effect grazing was having at the time, in the 2003 fires, the Bogong High Plains, the southern end was grazed by cattle, whatever effect the cattle might have had on fuel reduction per se, it didn't translate into landscape scale reduction in either the proportion of country burnt or the severity with which it was burnt.
And you were speaking specifically about that 2003 fires. Was there similar evidence or information gathered in previous fires?
Well, it's the Bogong High Plains was a very good laboratory, as it were, because we had adjacent areas that were grazed and ungrazed and relatively similar sorts of landscapes, so you could sort of control for other factors. I was involved in work on the Wellington High Plains and Holmes Plain in 1998 following a fire there, but we didn't really have the landscape scale capacity to compare grazed with ungrazed. But a lot of the grazed country was burnt and burnt relatively severely in that particular fire as well.
What about anecdotal evidence? People say that they saw areas that were grazed and survived the fire and other areas didn't.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important part of building up the portfolio of knowledge and evidence. But it's, you know, it's only one or two spots in the landscape. And so then you ask the question, well, if you go somewhere else in the landscape, can you see the reverse? And that was certainly the case on the Bogong High Plains. I mean, there were a couple of spots that I went to where, you know, it had been grazed and hadn't burnt or burnt relatively lightly, and, you know, right next door, 100 metres away, behind a fence that hadn't been grazed for 30 years, one of my experimental plots, some of the country was burnt relatively severely. But you go, you know, another 100 metres the other side of the other side of the fence, and the pattern was reversed. The point I'm making is that you've got to go to lots of places in the landscape. So one or two spots, good. It's a start, but you've got to, you know, really wander across the landscape and cover, tens of kilometres.
Mm. Dr. Dick Williams is with me. He's the Senior Principal Research Scientist for Ecoscience Ecosystem Sciences at CSIRO. Very long title, Dick
Williams. It's a shocker.
I'll just call you a CSIRO expert.
I think we've gone through about four divisional name changes since I joined CSIRO 20 years ago.
Yeah. Can you then manipulate fuel and fuel levels? Do you believe, I mean, when we look at the issue of the cattle grazing, but can you do that? And what is the cost of doing that?
Well, you can. You can do, there's a long history of manipulating fuels in fire research in Australia. And, I mean, I spend most of my time in Darwin and work in the tropical savannas of the north. And we spend a lot of time doing experimental work where we're actually manipulating fuels to see what effect it has on fire behaviour. And so that's a, you know, that's a very big part of the work that, you know, CSIRO and other people that have been involved in fire science in Australia have done over the years. So you can certainly manipulate fuels by different sorts of ways, and the whole idea of doing prescribed burning, for example, is to manipulate fuels. You reduce the level of fuel in the landscape at particular points. You can do the same with grazing animals and, you know, work out the level of reduction in relation to the level of production, and that's a very, you know, it's a very important point to make. But doing this sort of thing at landscape scale, you need, you know, lots of points in the landscape. You need to have a good understanding that what you have observed at one particular spot is representative of the whole of the landscape. So you need to replicate, and you need to, you know, have an idea that the treatment that you are trying to engender at one particular point of the landscape applies elsewhere. So it can be done, but you know it's you need to put some effort into it.
How closely are you going to be watching this trial?
Oh, very, very closely. Mm. I'm interested in anything to do with fire research. One point I would make about fuels, though, is that the fire ecology of southeastern Australia, when you're thinking about the fire ecology of the whole of the southeast, we've also got to bear in mind that we are subject to some of the most severe fire weather in the world. So one of the things that you need to do in trying to work out the impact of fuel reduction at a point is work out what that might imply for the behaviour of fires away from that point where you haven't reduced fuels under conditions of increasingly severe fire weather. So fuel reduction stories and fuel reduction trials are, you know, all very much part and parcel of it, but it's really only a part of the story, and we need to understand the relative impact of weather. And we also know from a lot of detailed study in southeastern Australia that as fire weather ramps up, the effectiveness of fuel reduction at points in the landscape in holding up fires, as it were, ramps down. So there's a very, very strong interaction between weather and fuels that we need to be aware of in southeastern Australia.
Mm. Dick Williams, good to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
No worries, Celine.